You're listening to Investify, preaching financial independence and assisting investors to achieve a more flexible and free lifestyle through smart financial planning and real estate investing. If leaving the corporate world and jumping into this thriving industry is what you desire, tune in and listen to stories of like-minded individuals who made the leap to financial independence.
What's going on, everybody? You are listening to Investify. My name is Craig Curlop, a.k.a. The Fi Guy, and I'm here with my co-host, Mr. Chad, the Dad, Rocky. What up, Chad?
What's going on, man?
How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing pretty good today. Let's see, anything new? Man, just working hard with buyers, and I feel like I'm working 12-hour days, but I really enjoy it and love it, so things are going good.
Yeah, man. Same here, dude. Same here. We got, was lucky enough to get a couple people under contract, and then also got ourselves under contract, me and one of our coworkers, actually, Julie, the person, you know, the other kind of admin gal that we got, we're
right.
Under contract on the house.
I feel like that came out of nowhere. Where how did that stem from?
Yeah, you know, she was like, we want to buy an investment property. And I was like, well, like, I need to buy something this year. And I just am like, well, let's partner on it. And we don't have to put as much down and all that. And so, we're buying a property. It's going to be like a rent by the room type thing over in Lakewood. I think it's a pretty good location, pretty good spot. And so we'll see how it goes.
That's awesome. Well, congrats.
Yeah. Thanks, man. So stuff in the hopper. We're definitely moving and grooving here. And if you guys are in Denver or looking to buy in Denver, there are definitely deals still to be had, even with higher rates, even with the quote unquote inflated price. And so wherever you're at, guys, we're here to help. And so speaking of helping, we've got Daniel Rustine on today's show. You may know him as Optimize My Airbnb, who's got actually a pretty good selling book on optimizing Airbnb listings. And that's kind of like what this dude's all about. And his story is cool.
Yeah. No, I was excited to see that he was on today. I could probably spend another 2 hours talking to him. He's an extremely knowledgeable person when it comes to especially Airbnb, from going from working there, to kind of taking the knowledge and then being an entrepreneur, let alone his lifestyle. If I were to go back to my college days, he is what I wanted to do. Literally travel the world and I'm sure he's got responsibilities, but very, very little responsibilities. That sounds amazing. I wanted to once, I bought a book of how to live on a cruise ship. Like you just leave your life and then you just go and you hop around cruise ships. And I bought this book and I was literally going to do it. And then I got a girlfriend and then plans changed.
That happens. It's funny. I had the same exact plans of like, I was going to go. It was like April of 2021, right? I was thinking about this in probably like 2019 before COVID, right? But I was like, April 2021, I'm going to quit my job and I'm going to go and I'm going to travel and be financially free. And like whatever happens, happens after that. And then COVID happened. I actually quit my job like a year and a half before that. And then I met my now wife and now we're settled up in Idaho on a farm. So like sometimes life throws total curveballs at you. I think if you do want to travel the way he does it, I mean, if you think about Airbnbs, not only does he have the experience of working at Airbnb, of managing Airbnbs, like before he became truly an entrepreneur, and then he started managing other people's Airbnbs. He also is at new Airbnbs every month doing the long-term stays. Right. And so he kind of hits the experience from every angle. And so this is a really, truly, truly fascinating story. And, you know, keep listening towards the end. It takes a little bit for us to get into the for real deal. But the for real deal is it's one like we have not ever, ever seen before on the show. So with that being said, let's bring Daniel Rustine onto the show. Just kidding. Before we get to Daniel Rustine, we need to ask you shamelessly for a rating and review on the show. So if you haven't already, please, please, please leave us a rating and review on iTunes. We super appreciate it. Make sure you're sharing this episode with your friends, especially if your friends are someone that wants to travel while still making some good money. Thank you very much. Now to Daniel Rustine. This episode of Investify was brought to you by the FI team, a team of investor-friendly agents that service all 50 states, If you are looking to house hack, to invest, grow your portfolio, and want a true investor-friendly agent, go to thefiteam.com and click get started. And we can't wait to have a good conversation with you.
Danielle Rustine, welcome to the show, my friend. How you doing today, dude?
I'm doing well today. I'm glad to be here, Craig. Thanks for having me on.
Glad. Yeah, man. I'm glad to have you on. And you say be here, but tell us where you are.
As of a week ago, I'm in Tulum, Mexico. I spent a lot of time in Latin America and Medellin specifically, but I decided to give Tulum a go with all the hype. I'm here looking at investments, just getting a lay of the land, visiting the beach, visiting the hotel zone. I'm living in the city.
That's awesome, man. I love that. Do you speak Spanish?
Yes, I do.
Nice. That's going to help in Medellin and in Tulum. But awesome, Daniel. Well, why don't we kind of rewind the tape a little bit and kind of figure out, you know, understand where you all started, like where your journey started in terms of when you first heard about financial independence and you can live this kind of atypical lifestyle?
Well, it's interesting. The actual FI, financial independence, I've kind of recently heard about. I know it's been around for a long time, but the actual term I recently discovered. But I have been on that journey, personal journey, for a while anyways, even going back as far as on my personal YouTube channel, I just recorded a video, which is about five investing platforms. And in there, I talk about a little bit of my journey. And I think it's very unusual for human beings in general. But when I was in high school, I opened three bank accounts at my local bank accounts, and I invested in certificates of deposit. At that time, it was probably just $100 or $200. So I've always been in this. Money investing has always been in my genetics without thinking about it.
Mm-hmm. It's funny that you invested in like CDs. I actually did the same thing, but you couldn't, and I didn't mean to. I just was like, my mom said, if you're not going to use the money, just put it in a CD. And so I did, but it sounds like you probably were a little bit more intentional about it, but like, can you describe, like, no one really talks about CDs. It's kind of more of like general finance stuff that personally, I probably wouldn't do it today, but tell us about it.
CDs are certificates of deposit, and you're giving the bank your money guaranteed for a fixed period of time, typically 3 months minimum, but it could be as long as I think 5 or even 10 years. And the bigger amount and the longer time frame, the increase in interest rate. And it's not even that good. I think back when I did it, it was like 5%. I think nowadays it's like 2 or 3%. But it's a very easy thing to do. Your existing bank, no matter what it is, if it's a credit union, Wells Fargo, they already have them in place. You can set it up in a day or maybe right away and put money in there and start earning a little bit. It's a nice introduction, I guess, if you're a total beginner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a fail-safe way to make 2 to 5% return on your investment. And if you look at it from the bank's perspective, is they're getting a 2 to 5% loan for a very extended period of time, most likely. And they can go lend that out at 10, 11%. And that's how they make their money.
Yeah. I mean, don't they lend out my money anyways?
They do lend it out anyways. But yeah. But now they're guaranteed that you're not going to take it. So you're going to, I think they're paying for that guarantee, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
So awesome, Daniel. So you started, at what age were you doing that? And like, or what year was it?
That would have been 2004, 2005.
Okay. 2004, 2005.
I was like 15-ish, 14, 15. 16, okay. Something like that.
Like high school type age. And then, so you've got high the school, money mindset. Yeah. You've got that money mindset kind of ingrained in your head. Was that natural thing, or did you read a book, or your parents talk to you, or?
That was just a natural thing. Parents didn't talk to me, didn't read a book. I mean, I may have, and I may have forgot it, but as I recall, it made sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so also keep in mind, you know, I was a different kid. I wasn't, I'm naturally very introverted. I've learned to be less introverted, but especially in high school, I went to a high school with all guys. I did play sports, but I wasn't, you know, extroverted. So I didn't have any friends. I wasn't going to parties. I wasn't doing that stuff. But I've always been, as I've learned, as I've gotten older, if I have nothing to do, I fill the void with stuff, with productive stuff. And so I think back then, because I wasn't dating girls and going to parties, I like had a bunch of extra time, and I don't just like sit and watch Netflix, which wasn't a thing back then. And so I decided to channel my energy into opening bank accounts. And I did some other financial related stuff. I arbitraged buying CDs in what are those, house sales, and then selling them to the CD stores.
So compact disc CDs, not, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. CD, yeah. Compact disc CDs.
Gotcha.
Daniel, where did you grow up?
In the Silicon Valley, if people are familiar with California, it's in between San Francisco and San Jose on the peninsula there. It's a city called Redwood City.
Sure. Okay.
Oh, cool. Beautiful. I used to live and work in Palo Alto for like a few years, 3-4 years.
Yeah, it's
your neighbor.
A lot of people have connections there. Oracle is, I think, founded in Redwood City or Redwood Shores, and there's a lot of big all the investment companies are on Palo Alto, Sand Hill Road. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. No, it's awesome, man. So I mean, you had this kind of entrepreneur thing in your blood. Maybe it wasn't from your parents, but you just had it somehow. And so, you know, you go through high school, maybe you went to college, but like, so kind of what were your next steps after that?
That was in high school and college. Yeah, nothing to do with anything investing. I had a very traditional path. I studied accounting. I got an accounting job. I became a CPA. I did public accounting. I was, looking back on it, I probably hated it. I use that word with reservation, but I really didn't enjoy going to work at all, which made up a large portion of my day back then. I bounced around from a few companies. I eventually landed at Airbnb, which is like the first of maybe three steps of getting to where I am now. That was in 2013, I believe. Yeah.
You landed a job at Airbnb?
Correct.
Oh, awesome. Up in San Francisco.
Yep, the headquarters.
Yeah. So where, like what were you doing for them? Just accounting?
Yeah, I was their accountant.
Like their accountant? Like their one accountant?
No. There was a team at that point. I think there was 13 in the accounting department. Some were financial analysis, some were tax, and some were accounting. At that point, the company was already valued at well over $1 billion. It was already a giant company, but nobody heard about it in 2013. Like nobody.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. And so tell us a little bit about that. Like, did you get any inspiration from working at Airbnb?
Not related to really financial independence, but kind of somewhat, is like I did the CPA because I thought I was good at math. I liked it. I liked the tax route more, but I decided to go into the audit route. So I did public auditing and I really, looking back on it, like I said, hated it. And then I realized, all right, maybe if I work for a private company, I'll like it more. So I went to a private company and I equally hated it. I really disliked it. I wasn't learning. I didn't feel like I was, not that I wasn't good at it. I wasn't good at it, but I just had no passion. I didn't want to be good at it. I wanted to devote no time to doing this. So then I realized, all right, maybe if I go to a company that I like. So I did public auditing, which is where you go to a bunch of companies and you audit them. Then I did a private company, which is you have more routine, you have more of a team. And then but I didn't like the company. And then I was like, well, what if I like the company? Okay, I'm still doing accounting. I like the team and I like the company. So I was at Airbnb, loved the company, really loved the company, what they were doing and their mission. Loved the team for accounting team, super cool folks. But there was that third thing. I was still doing accounting. And so I realized at that point, like, just, I don't like doing this. This is terrible. I'm not going to be an accountant for the rest of my life.
Awesome. So I think it's kind of funny that you like went down the path of, okay, you thought you liked accounting because you went to school for it, but then you realized you didn't like accounting. And so you're like, oh, well, maybe it's because you don't like the audit side. You don't like to be the bad guy being an audit. So then you kind of say, okay, well, like, what if I go to a company? So you kind of like got all three things in the place of like the job you thought you liked at a company you thought you liked with the people you thought you liked. And you may have liked the people in the company, but you still just hated the job so much that there's no way that could be your future. And so what did you do after, how long were you at Airbnb and like, when did you make that move?
Well, I was there for 3 years until I started working for a local property manager, a local Airbnb property manager. That was my transition. And it was a big transition. It was a scary transition because I'm a CPA. I have a good job according to society, according to my friends, according to my family. I have benefits. I'm working at a well-known startup at this point. But then I go to a local Airbnb property management company. I'm working from home. I'm doing more entrepreneurial business type things. I coordinate a new website build. I coordinate some marketing. I coordinate deals with cleaners and I hire folks. I expand the business I triple it. I go from, you know, 30 listings to 90 listings. I triple the revenue and I feel good. It's the first time where I feel like, whoa, I'm like, I thought working at home was super a bad idea because when I worked at home doing accounting, I was super unproductive, even less productive than I was at the office. And I attributed that to home, but no, it was just the work. If I liked the work, I was actually tremendously productive at home in my own space. And I did that for a year. So that's like the middle transition. The first transition was Airbnb, leaving Airbnb, working for a property manager. And then during that is when I kind of realized, like, all right, I then started my own property management business, which I still have it today, but I transitioned out into doing kind of being a consultant for Airbnb hosts, helping them make more money. And that's kind of where the financial independence started gaining steam. Do I have to live in San Francisco? Super expensive. Can I live somewhere else that's less expensive? I started questioning a lot of things about my current lifestyle and the lifestyle I had for the past 8 years in San Francisco.
Wow. Yeah. No, that's amazing, man. So I kind of want to like just go to the place of you're at Airbnb, you make that transition to the property manager. Like, how did you get even introduced to that property manager? How did you even like get to that point? And how do you like swallow that pill of making probably six figures to probably making maybe half of that at a, you know, property management company?
Well, the reason why I got introduced to the property management company was because at Airbnb, they ran a program where they said, hey, $500, if you, an employee of Airbnb, refer a host, we're going to give you and the host $500. And for me, that was like, that's a lot of money. Like, and I think I can refer a lot of hosts. So I went out and I did a bunch of things. One of the things I did was I got in touch with some property managers and I was like, hey, you guys are going to onboard hosts. How about, you know, you give them $500 or you take the $500. And so obviously a lot of people were like, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. We'll definitely do that. So I ended up leaving Airbnb with 36 referrals, about $15,000 in credit. The next best had like, I was like three times more than the next best, which raised a lot of people's eyebrows. They're like, what's going on? Why did the accountant like just destroy this competition? And so I actually got rehired by Airbnb as a contractor in a different department doing sales type stuff. And I did that for, I think, a year. And I just killed it there as well. I was number one in every single metric. And so, yeah, that's how I got connected with the property manager while I was actually working at Airbnb.
Gotcha.
Just want to see, like, as far as timeline, because I know, like, with Airbnb, it's every year there's kind of a transition period here. Especially, it's obviously pre-COVID at this point, but I think you said you're at Airbnb for three total years. If you could just give us a timeline.
So now we're at, by the time I leave Airbnb and I'm doing the property management and starting my own stuff is 2016. I started at Airbnb in 2013.
Okay.
Okay, cool. And so then now you're at the property management company and you're just like, you don't have a, like your role is like, you wear a lot of hats, right? You're kind of like a jack of all trades at a small, it's a small company. Is that right?
Super, super. I think I was director, but it was a super small company. I think I was the second or third employee.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what were some things that you learned kind of under the tutelage of your Airbnb property manager boss?
The principal thing that I learned was just that I'm good at what I'm doing. I feel connected. I don't need someone managing me. I don't need someone telling me what to do. I feel totally in charge. If the owner left, I could run the business as I felt I was running the business. So that's what got me started thinking like, oh, wow, you know, I just wasted like 5 years doing accounting where I had this like terrible feeling. But now I'm in a position where I know what to do. I'm very conscious about what to do to grow the business. I know the next steps.
Mm-hmm. I think it's really cool. And for our listeners of, I think there's this, I guess, mindset of a lot of people of you work a 9-to-5 from your 22 to your 55, and that's just the way to do it. Maybe it's more of our parents' generation. But really cool of what you realized and you thought like, I don't like this job. I'm going to go out. I'm going to find something I do like. You kind of fell into it, but you realized that and you bet on yourself and you won, which is really cool.
Yeah. And these bets that you're making, they're low risk bets, right? Like there's nothing that you did. Like it's just such a natural thing of like, you want to go do something? Well, go take a pay cut, go join someone who's just starting or at 30 doors that knows like maybe one or two steps ahead of you as to where they're at, learn as much as you can from them. And then, you know, you can then decide if it makes sense to stay with them or go do your own thing. So talk to us about that transition, like how long you were with that property management company. And then when you went ahead and started doing your own thing.
I was with that property management company for 1 year, and the exit from Airbnb, though, that was the most traumatic, because it was actually, I had in front of me accounting and Airbnb at this point. And the accounting route was the more secure route. I could get a job anywhere, et cetera. I already had the license. I already had great experience, great resume. But I decided to push that aside and go to the Airbnb route instead. And even though I don't know how it sounds now, but it actually felt when I walked out of the Airbnb doors, I felt great, which was surprising because I thought it was scary at the time, but I felt great. Like this weight was lifted off my shoulder, like actually a physical feeling. Wow. It was January.
You were walking out of the doors of Airbnb and that was like the feeling your shoulders were light and you were.
At that point, like an entrepreneur or like, were you going to just start your own thing?
Yeah. So that was the biggest change for you was like the Airbnb to the property management company.
That was the biggest change. And then I worked for the property management company for a year. And end of that year, I kind of realized like I was actually going to become an owner in that company, a part owner. And I realized, well, two things. The owner doesn't want to give me what I think I'm worth, which is very common. You know, the employee, I think I'm worth a lot more than the owner does. Great. That's a common thing. And number two, even if the owner did give me what I thought I was worth, I'm now putting my eggs in their basket. My future depends on them. And I wasn't comfortable with that. So I started creating my own property management company. And I did that. I did that for a very, like I said, I still have that now, but it's very boutique. I'd never managed more than five at one time. I currently have four. And I created my own, but I quickly pivoted out of that. I went to Airbnb Open in Los Angeles in November, and there was problems that, you know, where I was doing property management, I had to be there, I had to coordinate calls, and that's when it clicked, like, oh, you know, unless I grow this company very big, I'm going to have to be in San Francisco on the ground every day for a very long time. And that was the point where I was like, I'm not going to do this, and I started selling services online to Airbnb hosts about how they can rank higher in Airbnb search.
We hope this episode is inspiring you to take action. If you're thinking about becoming a real estate agent or an agent who wants to join an investor-friendly team, just hit me up on Instagram at TheFiGuy because we are growing our team in Denver, Seattle, San Diego, and Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, but also adding to our network in all 50 states. And if you didn't already know this, the FI team provides a super supportive environment with one-on-one coaching, accountability, and ongoing training to help develop kick-ass, rockstar, investor-friendly real estate agents. So hit me up on Instagram at the FI guy, and we'll set up a time to chat. Can't wait to chat with you.
So what are some of these things that you've gathered from the property management job, or from you doing your own consulting that are like ways to optimize your Airbnb?
There's a lot of things you can do, but the biggest thing I think I've learned is that a lot of hosts, they need to understand that unless they're doing this professionally, the people who I work with are hosts with 1, 5, maybe 10 properties, but they're not doing it as a full-time thing. They have other things going on, but they realize the ROI, they realize they had a good deal. There's so much specialty in this world that you could be an expert in Airbnb, you could be an expert in investment banking, you could be an investment in your day job, doing recruiting, whatever it is. So what I'm saying is people are typically employees, and that's a different mindset than Airbnb, which is you're an entrepreneur. You're running a business. You have an online reputation to maintain. And so I would say is hosts need to understand that unless you want to really take a lot of time and dig into Airbnb and figure out how you can optimize your online listing, optimize your hosting, optimize your pricing, which you can do for sure, but it takes a lot of conscious thought and learning. You can outsource that just as you do your taxes. You can do your own taxes. You can outsource that to experts. And I'm not the only one. Go on YouTube, go on this and that. I'll finish up this kind of part with a quick story of me coming to Tulum. There's thousands of listings, and there's thousands, maybe tens of thousands of listings going up. I had such a hard time choosing what Airbnb to reserve because they all look generic. They all look the same. I couldn't tell what was private space and public space. And that's just because a lot of these hosts, they're not putting extra thought into it where they need to. So I ended up choosing randomly, which is the last thing you want a guest to do. Because I didn't know, I really chose randomly because I didn't know what to choose because they all look the same.
Mm. Just going back to your point of running a business, I'm happy to hear that you said that. I, as an agent, and I have some short-term rentals myself, but I have a lot of buyers that I work with that need some consultation of what strategy to take. I always say that exact same thing of this is a business. Like, you're not just buying a house and then just going to throw it up on Airbnb and hope for the best. There's way too much competition these days to do that. So you have to have professional photos and the optimization, and you have to think of it as a business, and it's not for everybody. But I think that's a great point that you made of, and it's kind of an interesting story about Tulum as well. Like, you got to set yourself apart. You got to be the best of the best. So yeah, I resonate with that well, and I'm glad to hear you say that.
Yeah. So like, what are some of those like top two or three ways that you would say someone could set themselves apart?
Ideally, it starts before they get the listing. If you can pick the right micro neighborhood in the right market, that's what you really need to do. But if you already have a house, that's the investing part. If you already have a house, what you can do to set yourself up for success is the easiest thing to do is optimize your online listing. Now, I have my own sets of strategies that I do. I think my theory in general is less is more. Airbnb, if you go on their website, they will have you believe that you need four angles of the bedroom, four angles of every angle of every room, 90 photos for a two-bedroom, two-bathroom house. No. If I were to optimize your listing or manage your listing, a two-bedroom, two-bathroom house would have maybe 20 photos. If I had a four-bedroom, four-bathroom house, I'm not showing you all those bedrooms. I'm not showing you all those bathrooms, unless they were all very unique. Why a guest doesn't even really not keeping track. If there's four bathrooms that look the same, I'm showing you the master and one of the common bathrooms, and that's it. All I want to show you as the host, showing the FPG, I call them, future potential guest, is the minimum they need to make the booking. And that's typically a lot less than most hosts add in there. Too many photos, too much text, titles that aren't optimized.
This reminds me of like, it sounds like you've written a couple of books, and we're going to get to that. I've written a book, got another, or actually has two books, one more on the way. And one thing that, look, what I'm writing is like every word in that book needs to have purpose. In a podcast, every word that you say needs to have purpose. Otherwise, it's just fluff. And so it sounds like it's the same concept with Airbnb photos. It's like, you don't want someone sitting on your photos for 20 minutes scrolling through, trying to piece together the house in their head, right?
Well, they're not going to give you 20 minutes. They're going to give you 6 to 8 photos first. But yeah, I get what you're saying. What did Mark Twain attributed? If I had more time, I would have written a shorter letter, something like that.
Yeah.
One of the comments I get in my first book, which I'm not, I guess I am an author now. I have 4 books, but I wasn't an author back then. I just wrote a book because my competition had a book and I thought I would write a book. But one of the comments that I got often is, this book is no fluff. It's just straight to the point, just bam, 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 actionable advice. And that is, that's exactly what I was going for.
Sounds like you're an accountant. It's still got that in your blood. Awesome. So I think pictures is really the biggest thing. What do you do with like the description? Does that matter as much as people think it does?
Well, people actually, I would argue, don't think it matters. There's a lot of hosts think guests don't read, so it doesn't matter. It's interesting that you say that. That's kind of the common knowledge that I've gathered from the community is, oh, guests don't read, you know, so hosts don't pay attention to it. So what does that lead to? All the hosts have this big block text and way too much text or no text at all. The text is actually the most important part of the listing, I would say, or it can be. And the reason why is because if an FPG is reading your text, that means that they're so close to booking your listing. They just need some more information because they're looking at the photos first. They probably read the title. The text is the last thing they do just before they make a booking. So how I do it is I bullet point out your text, bullet point out your best 5 amenities that aren't shown in the listing. For example, in my Airbnb in Medellin, Colombia, I have a sound system. You can't see that in the photos. I've actually edited the photos, so you can see that in the photos, but typically you couldn't see that in the photos. That's great for text. Some people have radiant floor heating, great for text. The speed of the Wi-Fi, great for text. Things you can't see. We're adding in additional information that the guest is looking for at that time that can't be seen with the... And one more point on that. For the title, I see this happen all the time. The host has their best amenity up front, which is fine, but then they have in text their best amenity in the leftmost portion of their title, which is the best real estate of your title, because that's what everyone sees. It's not going to be cut off on mobile. So they'll have like rooftop jacuzzi in the photo, and then the title says rooftop jacuzzi, and that's repeat information. You've wasted a big portion of the guest's attention.
I was just going to ask you that. So like in the title, oftentimes too, I've got a couple of Airbnbs as well, and I might say like, you know, like cozy place close to town, something like that, right? Like you're probably like, No, like you can tell it's cozy by the pictures, or like, you know, like I can see the map that it's close to town. Right. So like, that's to me, like you would probably laugh at my Airbnb listing, honestly, but, yeah. Like what would you recommend in a listing that would be something that you can't get by the location, you can't get by the pictures, that's still worth your six words that you can put in there or whatever.
If you were to read on Airbnb's website, when you're setting up a new listing, they're going to say, hey, a great title is cozy room next to town, just as you put it. That would be a perfect optimized title for Airbnb. That's a terrible title. You might as well not even have a title. And I mean that, zero title. Adjectives aren't, the guest isn't, okay, luxurious. The guest isn't, okay, the host said it's luxurious, so it's luxurious. The guest already looked at the photos. They've already decided if it's if it looks cozy, if it looks luxurious, if it's bohemian style, you know? And the map feature is highly used on Airbnb. So typically the guest already knows, you know, roughly where they want to stay. They've typically zoomed in the map. So what you should be doing in the title, taking into account what I've already said, is your best amenities. Not what you think is the best amenities, but the best amenities for the FPG. You might have a sexy rooftop jacuzzi in downtown San Francisco. But people who have visited that place before, it's a high repeat visitor destination, know that what they actually want coming with two kids is a private garage space, which is not sexy, but it's also very uncommon. So I would argue, put that in the title, put the parking, highlight the parking, SUV parking in the garage or something like that. Whatever the FPG, your ideal FPG wants most should go in the title.
And how do you determine what that is if you're starting a new Airbnb?
There's numerous ways you can determine what your ideal FPG really seeks. One of those ways is you can use data tools. I'm an advocate of actually going to the market and with your feet and walking around and seeing what's going on. That's what I call a soft data. And there's another analysis, which is hard data, which a lot of people buy homes sight unseen. They're just looking at the hard data, the numbers. I like to go there. So in Medellin, I realized as a guest there that proximity to Parque Jerez is, which is the main park, is ideal, walkable within 10, maybe 15 minutes. That was just based on my observations. You're not going to see that in a data provider, but you can use a data provider. They will tell you what amenities are most common in the area. That doesn't necessarily translate to ROI or what FPGs want, but there, it's a data point. Also, what you can do is you can look at your competition, which I recommend everyone do. Go on Airbnb, search for 4 bedrooms, 4 bathrooms, whatever you have, and create a wish list based on your competition and examine them. You could do this if you already have a listing or before. Examine them. What do they have? When you're investing and doing this stuff, a lot of it is educated guesses. You're taking in data and you're mixing that data in your head and coming out with an answer. So for me, that answer was proximity to Parque Jerez, a hot tub, a kitchen, not one. No one cares about a kitchen because they're not coming for the kitchen. They want to eat out. I'm right next to the restaurant road.
Gotcha. Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. And so, this is super helpful, man. And I think, like, do you have any Airbnbs yourself? Or, you know, it sounds like you got into managing them right away, and you probably learned a ton. And it was awesome because you probably could, like, split test with other people's listings, right? As to like what works and what doesn't. And that's probably where your optimize kind of came from. Is you've just got so many iterations of managing Airbnbs. When did you decide to actually start buying one for yourself?
I tried to buy a property in Las Vegas on the east side of UNLV. I did a whole bunch of research. This was 2012, before I even heard about Airbnb. And I went in, I created a company, I funded it with my brother, I got my brother to co-sign. At the end of the day, they would not let me buy this property. It would have been a great investment back then. That was my first foray. And then I waited 10 years. From 2012 or 11 to 2021 is when I purchased my first property internationally in Colombia.
Wow. So you went international before you even bought something in the States. That's something I haven't heard before.
The reason I did that was because for 5 years before that, I had been traveling the world, slow travel, moving every month. I've lived in 100 cities. And so I started seeing the value differential. Like, for example, here in Tulum, it's very expensive. That's not bad. Typically, when things get more expensive, the value increases. Here in Tulum, that's not really actually the case. Things are very expensive, but the value isn't there. There's dirt roads outside. There's fixable things. The energy went off yesterday and today for a period of 8 hours. So it's very expensive, but the value isn't there. In Medellin, the reason why I chose there was one of the biggest reasons was you were paying here and the value you were receiving was here. And my hands are, you're paying and my hands is low and the value you're receiving is my hand is going up very high. So the value differential there was big. And that's what I saw as a lot of potential future growth, because people go there, they have good experiences, and then they leave and they slowly share their experiences and more people go, and it compounds over time and the market grows via tourism.
Chad, you know what this sounds like?
I do.
Sounds like the real deal. All right, Daniel, this is the first deal that you do. So we want to kind of dig deep into it. I think it's super, super cool. I think you're the first guest on our show out of 181 people that their first property they purchased was international. And so talk to us first about how you even went through the process of buying something international. How do you go through the lending? How do you, like, are there any differences from buying in the US?
So there's actually a chicken and an egg problem. There is lending. You can get lending, but you need credit history, right? They don't take your credit history from the US and then apply it to Colombia or wherever you're at. So, but you can't get credit history without a bank account, but you can't get a bank account without a local ID. So typically there is no lending. You could get a business loan or a loan in the US and apply it there, bring the money over to Colombia. But I purchased my house with cash, and that's typically how it's done in Colombia. I think 80 or 90% of the houses don't have mortgages on them.
Wow. And so how much did you buy it for in US dollars, if you can think of that?
I bought it for $500,000.
Okay.
US dollars. Yeah. And my seller was selling it in US dollars, which is another unique kind of component of this market, because I'm also making money in US dollars. So I'm in a Colombian market buying a house in US dollars, making US dollars, but selling in Colombian pesos.
Wow. And so how did you come up with $500,000 cash?
Well, I'm 36 years old and I have been investing for a very long time. There's no one reason. Some of it came from crypto. I did very well with crypto. I got in that game quite early. Some came from working, saving, investing. I've been investing since 2007 in stocks. I took my, that's probably where most of the money came from, is stocks. I remember I invested in 2009 and I made quite a bit of money because that's when the stock market was still down. I invested in March 14th, 2020, big amounts. And I remember that because the World Health Organization announced a pandemic on the 16th, like 2 days later, which was, everyone was kind of expecting that. So I bought it and it doubled within a year and I sold it. I most recently bought Netflix when it was 200. Now it's like 500. So I'm a good investor via my temperament. And so I've done that various times. I did Chipotle when it went down. I did Southwest when it went down. I did when there was an oil spill, I did then. So I, that's
BP.
BP. Yeah.
Awesome, man.
How did you, I think we talked a little bit about how you chose that city, but did you buy it specifically to Airbnb it? And then also how many bed and bath was it? Is it?
I bought it specifically to Airbnb it, correct. It was an Airbnb before I got it. And the owner showed me his account, and he was making $40,000, $45,000 a year. He was not using smart pricing. He was charging $500 a night all year round. This for me, when I buy, I'm looking in the US right now to buy my first US property. I will heavily favor a listing that doesn't use dynamic pricing. Because with this listing, I did various things that improved the listing. But the biggest thing, I think, is dynamic pricing. And I've quadrupled the amount of money. I'm making $160,000 a year, where he was making $45,000 a year. He didn't see that potential. It was funny because he was explaining to me how Airbnb works and this and that. I obviously kept private what I do professionally. So that was a fun negotiating process. Cool. That's Superhost. Okay, I should get that. That's a goal. Things like that.
Yeah. So how did you work that? So like, did it start at 500,000 and you negotiated it down, or what was that negotiation process like?
There's some unique things about buying internationally, or specifically in Colombia, is because people own their property, and people who own nice properties are typically very wealthy. There's wealthy people and poor people. There's less middle class in Colombia. People sit on their house for years and they don't sell it. They're like, I think it's worth this and I will sell it when it's worth that. And that they do that because for the past 20 years, that's been a great winning strategy for them. Eventually, the market catches up with what they think their property is worth, and they sell it at that rate and they're very happy. So I tried to buy, I think, two properties, and in both cases, I failed. In one case, I thought I was ready to go and like the owner disappeared. And I was like, am I buying this house or what's going to just disappear? So my requirement was that I need to buy from a foreigner. And so this guy was, a foreigner being a U.S. citizen. So this guy was U.S. citizen, which made the process very quick. By the time I knew it, I did some research. It was higher than my originally budgeted. I wanted to buy a place for $200,000 or $300,000. This was twice as high. Actually, it's interesting. When I first went to Medellin, I was looking at Airbnbs, and I recall seeing this listing, one of the most luxurious listings in all of Medellin at the time. And I remember thinking, like, wow, that looks awesome. You know, I didn't even think like one day maybe I could stay there. It was so out of my budget and everything. I was like, that just looks like an awesome, badass house. And then 4 years later, I ended up buying that house. Kind of a trip. It was one of the only listings that I remember back from 2017-18 checking out the Airbnb competition. Yeah.
That's wild. And so like you were in Medellin when you were buying this?
No, I wasn't. And I left Medellin upset because I'd been trying to buy a house and I was disappointed by how Colombians did negotiations. If there's any Colombians watching this, I apologize, but you probably are aware of this as well. So I left the country because of my 6 month time limit and I got presented another opportunity. It was not technically on sale, but I knew someone through my business. We met while I was there. There was another unit for sale in this building. I asked my friend about that unit. And my friend said, I wanted to know about the building. He told me about the building. And he said, by the way, the penthouse is being sold, if you're interested. So I said, sure, send me the details. Like I said, it was two times the price. But I ultimately decided to buy it because I thought I could make more on there. The ROI, the percent ROI was higher. So I flew back to Colombia. Everything was done within like some stuff was pre-done. But when I got back to Colombia, I think it was like 4 days between when process started signing papers and I moved into the house.
Wow. So I'm just kind of gathering and putting together what you said here, but the place that you purchased, tell me if I'm wrong. It's a luxurious place. It is on the penthouse and it is basically maybe one block away from the main street with all the restaurants and all the stuff. And you bought that for $500,000.
Correct.
So that right there is like the value is low. Or sorry, the value is high and the price is low. Right, for what you're getting, because that in an equivalent city in the US is probably going for 2 million plus.
It was a very unique situation because the owner thought he was getting a premium. I'm sure he was very happy with what he sold it for, but he used a property manager who didn't know what they were doing, as most property managers unfortunately don't. And so I saw that opportunity in the position I am, and I realized that what I can do with it. But for me, it was a deal, but it wasn't necessarily sold. Like other people who looked at this would be like, that's my Colombian lawyer, for example, when he saw the amount of pesos I was paying, which was 2 billion Colombian pesos, his head exploded. He was like, what are you doing? This is a bad idea. And I was like, it's a good idea. Please, you know, continue. And
yeah, that's funny. So how do you deal with a professional telling you that it's not like, because you're more professional though, right? That's like an inspector telling a structural engineer that the structure is bad, right? It's like, cool, bro. No, it's not.
Yeah. I mean, at that point, I knew who I am. I had done my research. So his opinion had no effect on me. I already made that decision. And same with the owner. The owner invited me over to his like fabulous house with a giant front door, I recall, and a living wall, and was trying to like talk me up and help me sell on it. But little did he know, I was already sold on it. I was like, oh, I'm going to make a killing on this house. So it was ultimately, and that's a key point, I think, in how I invest and how maybe other people invest and how when I do consultation calls, this is a common theme that I have to talk about. And one of the chapters in my new book called Profitable Properties is this specifically. And the idea is you are the output. So you see these lists online, for example, top 20 places to invest. If you take that as the output, you're making a bad investment in all likelihood. I want you to be the output. So that's an input. That's a data input. AirDNA or all the rooms is a data input. And you are taking that data, observing it, and ultimately pushing out an output. And that gives you confidence in your decision. Did what I just said make sense?
Maybe it's my brain. Chad's like, yeah, it makes sense.
Let me give you a real life story. A few years ago, I was in Playa del Carmen, Mexico. And I was looking at real estate in Tulum. I went to a real estate agent and they pulled up AirDNA. On AirDNA, they have a number, I think, or it's a grade. I think it's a grade. And they said, well, let's just say it's a number. They said, this property is ranked 95 out of 100. It's a great investment. And I was like, okay, how'd they get to that 95? And the agent was like, it's a 95. It's a great investment. So that's an example of they're taking that 95, they're taking that tool, and that's the output. No. Take that as the input, own analysis, and then, yeah.
I got you now. So it's kind of like, sorry, Chad, one sec. It's like Warren Buffett. This is how I'm going to equip with it. Like, is like back in the day, in the 50s or whatever, he learned to invest in stocks by seeing, like, looking at their balance sheets, looking at their income statements, whatever, and being like, the price of the stock doesn't make sense based on what I'm seeing here. And so the input is the financial statements in the stock. The output is like, this is undervalued. I need to make this higher. And so for your situation, for your real estate agent, you want to find 70s or 60s that really should be 90s, finding that inconsistency with the market in that number, and then make it truly the 90 or whatever that it should be. Does that sound about right? Am I understanding? Okay.
Yeah, just to that point, like, you're the expert. And so even looking at different, like, real estate strategies that, you know, somebody might be selling this house and they just think it's a long-term rental, just one person renting it, where you as the expert, you know, we can come in and say, actually, you know, you have 7 bedrooms here, we can rent it by the room. That person's not thinking about that. Like, they don't even know that strategy. And so you coming in is like, I know this, and the confidence and the proof of concept that you've seen, you can take that and make money up with it, because you're the expert, and you know, have a history of working there, and you understand, and you can do something different than what that person might be thinking.
Yeah. And it also helps put you in the right mindset. Whereas, for example, when I looked at this house, I didn't know beforehand that there was a stream going out front. Some people might have not noticed that, or they might not have given that much value. I thought that's a huge amenity. I have a private stream giving me water sounds the whole day and helping to block out street noise and the party noise. So some people might take that data in and not recognize it or not realize its potential. I thought it was a great potential. On another side, I have a park, which is just a bunch of trees, a future potential to be an actual park. There's Parque Ageras that prevents a park. I saw that and thought there's future potential there. Even the walk to Parque Ageras, which I mentioned, that walk is safe. There's lights. If you're on another town, the same amount, 9 minutes to Parque Ageras, but the walk there is extraordinarily dangerous feeling. There's no lights. You're walking in a very defined. So even though it's 9 minutes, that walk to get there is part of my output. It's a data input. It's part of my output.
Yeah, that's awesome. One question, I guess, changing the subject just a little bit, but you said you're looking in the United States to purchase a property. What are you looking for? I guess where and how are you doing that analysis?
That analysis, I have a giant spreadsheet on my computer. I have it narrowed down. That's the hardest thing, is I pick the right market. If you pick the right market, everything else is easy. So I'm taking my time to do this. I will say that there is a new development going in. It's called America's Heartland. It's a giant theme park. It's going to draw an international crowd, US crowd. And I like theme parks because it has year-round draw. People like markets that have seasonality. You make all your money in 6 months or 5 months or 7 months. I like markets that are just 100% all year round. So I'm looking right there tentatively, but I'm looking at everything from the state tax laws and short-term rental laws to the cost of the house, of course. What I want is, I'm looking at cities of a certain population size, but then I'm looking at where are the airports, how many cities are nearby, do we have drivable travel FPGs? Do we have FPGs that are going to visit? There's a lot going into it. Yeah. And unfortunately, I don't know where yet, but once I do, I will announce it publicly.
No, that's helpful. I know there's a lot. Yeah. There can be a lot of different factors for sure to consider.
So when picking a city, you know, whether this is investing in short-term rentals or long-term rentals, I feel like a lot of people get caught up in this analysis, and you're like an accountant. I'd probably say you're like grade A analysis guy that can like keep track of it all, remember what you did yesterday and like all that stuff. But a lot of people tend to look at, you know, 15 different cities and just kind of throw their hands up in the air and just like, you know what? I don't know which one the best one is, because frankly, I think there's going to be a lot of pros and cons to each of them. And it's going to be hard to find like that paradise of a place to invest. And so like, what would you give people's advice if they're not as analytical as you and are just like, where should I go?
Real estate investing is one of the investing activities that I do. And I preach anyone who is on my program or I talk to, I know that a lot of people do real estate investing. They're full on real estate investing. Some people recommend buying a real estate project every year, one a year. And so if someone were to come to me and this advice, I might say, probably don't invest in real estate because it's what I know. I mentioned hard data and soft data. I do both of them. I look at the numbers, but I also go and visit and I look at the soft data. How is it walking from, 9 minutes away to Parque Gittes? So this is a very serious decision for me. It's a very big asset. So if you're just going to randomly choose or rely on somebody else, I have many consultation calls where somebody bought based on someone else's analysis and it was a bad idea because they never visited it. And they're next to a highway and the fence is 3 feet tall and they can't raise the fence because of some law. So there's no privacy and there's extra noise. That is a pretty common situation in real estate. So my advice would be don't invest in real estate. You're not ready if you can't do the hard data analysis.
Fair enough. That's a straight to the point. I love it. And so I want to kind of talk to you a little bit about like more and more cities are cracking down regulation wise. I'm sure you're seeing that at least across the US. I'm not sure in Colombia, but like, how are you kind of adjusting your strategies based on that? Is there a plan B in case that the city, Medellin, shuts down short-term rentals for some reason or makes it harder or increases the taxes or whatever?
This is something that should be considered. There's a different types of markets. I break down markets into discovered and undiscovered markets. Discovered markets typically have more of these issues because, New York is a discovered market. Miami is a discovered market. Canggu, Bali, as an internationalist, is a discovered market. I like undiscovered markets because they're out of the limelight. STRs aren't a main focus right now. They have other focuses, especially internationally. There's a lot of other focus than STRs. But there is a point where you invest in a market and that market becomes, people come to me and they say, I'm not making as much my occupancy. Typically, I have a three-step process. Step one, optimize your online listing. Step two, optimize your hospitality, which is represented in your reviews. Step three, optimize your pricing. That typically takes care of most people. But if you already have an optimized listing, your great hospitality 5.0, and you know what you're doing on pricing and you're still not getting what you could be getting, then it could be the market dynamics have changed and it's time to leave. But the nice thing is, if you are doing this to be in the top 10% of the market, there's always going to be winners in the market. No matter what happens to that market, there will always be winners in that market. So you want to be in that top 10%. You don't want to be the 50th percentile where you're doing good when we're on an uptrend, but you're doing terrible when we're on a downtrend. You're fine during high season, but not fine during low season. High season and low season looks a lot different for the top 10% in the market. If you go to these data tools, they usually give you the occupancy, 50%. A lot of them, you can choose the 90th percentile. Check out that line between the 50th percentile and 90th percentile. The 90th percentile would typically be bopping up at 95%. The 50th percentile will be all over the place, way lower. So that's kind of my goal. And that's kind of my backup plan is be the best in the market. Be one of those winners in the markets. But there is some analysis that needs to be done. I can't say I have an answer there. It's hard to leave a market, a profitable market today where you think tomorrow it's not going to be profitable because of strict regulations coming into play. You kind of have to sit and wait it out because sometimes it happens, sometimes it doesn't happen. It's a tough situation.
Yeah, totally get that, man. And so you've mentioned and kind of alluded to your books a couple of times. You said multiple of them. Like, what inspired you to write a book and how has that helped your business and where it's at?
There's a gentleman called Chip Connolly. He used to be an executive at Airbnb. He might still be, I'm not sure. But back in 2017, my main competitor had a book. And so I just thought at that point, I should have a book. I think I can do better than I should have a book. So I decided to write a book. But I kind of put it on the back burner. I was kind of writing it, kind of not writing it. And then I asked Mr. Connolly if he would write my foreword. And when he said yes, that was the ultimate trigger for me to like, okay, now I'm going to work, 16 hours a day to get this book out. I wanted to get it out by Christmas time because I thought like, oh, it could be a Christmas gift. It wouldn't have been now knowing what I know now. But he ultimately didn't write my foreword, but that was the last trigger that did it. I published the book, I think, on January 3rd, 2018. And it started off slow, but over the years, word of mouth, it started gaining in popularity and it was... it's sold 50,000 copies since then. And then I wrote a follow-up book. That's called Optimize Your Airbnb. I wrote a follow-up in last year, 2023, called Profitable Properties. It is a complimentary book, Optimize Your Airbnbs for Airbnb. Profitable Properties takes a step back and we look at investing, choosing markets, investing. We talk about pricing, optimizing a direct book, how to do that, which I do recommend for most people.
Awesome. I love that, man. I love it. And so like, how does that parlay into, you know, your day-to-day business now? So I know you've got the property in Colombia. Looks like you're kind of looking, you got your sights set for number two, or do you have others that you actually own?
I own one in my name. I manage, like I said, never more than five. I manage at this point four. So if anyone is listening, I do remote management. My management style is very different. I do it. I think you alluded to it earlier. Very good. I keep the property management company to test strategies and to keep a foot in there. That's why I only do never more than five at a time. And I'm very choosy with who I pick. But
obviously, Airbnb has changed quite a bit since you were working there. And obviously, through the pandemic, where do you see it going as of today versus going forward?
I am overall disappointed with Airbnb as a business. I think that they haven't made the platform better. I think the mobile app was the best in 2015. So this is very disappointing, unfortunately. I think that they're obviously the market leader for a reason, and they have a lot of potential, but I don't see the business improving in any meaningful way. And so I don't know. I think what that means is Airbnb has created the market. A competitor now can come in and supersede Airbnb because of their poor management. Airbnb has the potential to change the ship. I think Brian Chesky, the founder, was a great founder, fantastic. But him still leading the company, you know, now he's a multi-billionaire. Does he still have that same passion? Should he still be leading the company? I'm unsure. I would guess no. That's why the company has been stagnant for many, many years. They've even said that the direct bookings aren't a concern of theirs. It's like, hello, it's a giant concern. I'm sure a third of your bookings are going off platform right under your nose and you don't even realize. It's a terribly managed company. Google, people talk about Google. That one is up and coming for sure. Potential, not really there, a little bit clunky to use. So Airbnb's still the main thing and everyone should be on there. But I really hope that they get better. They have such a strong potential there, but I recommend people to start creating a direct booking strategy to not rely 100% on Airbnb, because Airbnb's engineers can change the algorithm that makes you plummet in the search rank. You don't want to be 100% dependent on Airbnb. Also, if you do direct bookings and you get emails, you've got 1,000 emails of prior guests, you've got Instagram with 1,000 followers, that has economic value when you go to sell your house.
Absolutely. So have you sold any of your houses, or anybody, or has any of your people that you manage properties sold their houses and then sold the website along with it? And were you able to get more for the house because you've got some Airbnb assets for it with it?
People do sell it, but this collecting emails and whatnot is rather new. I'd say it's not even popular yet, but in the last couple years, it's starting to get a little bit new. So people have sold their houses, and that's one of the reasons why they exit my management. But I can't comment on how much they got for a functioning website and backend system.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah. No worries. Awesome. So what's next for you? So properties you manage, the handful of properties you manage, you've got the books, you're in Tulum traveling, you got the investment properties or the investment property. Yeah. Where do you want to be in a year from now?
Well, I like to, where I want to be, I'm focusing more on videos, both on my personal channel, which is Danny Boo Boo, and on my, that's more about travel, and then on Optimize My Airbnb was about Airbnb. I like passive investments. So, I invest with a bunch of platforms. I'll be publishing a video on my five favorite platforms, but that's where I want to push my money to, passive investments with good returns. I am looking for a property, and I'll do that when it makes sense to make an investment in a real estate investment. I'll do that, but I'm not out chasing a deal every single year. The idea is really financial independence, which is also kind of in a passive way. So making money passively, freeing up my time so I can travel, so I can do activities. I am still working on the Optimize My Airbnb website. I have a program that I launched with my book. I have a brand new website coming out any day now, and it's beautiful. I'm very proud of it, especially compared to my current website. It's gonna wow people, I hope. So those are my next steps.
Awesome, man. I love that. And so talk to us a little bit about, I'm curious about like traveling, right? Do you have a family, or are you single? Like what's kind of like your life like in that regard?
Yep, I am single. I've been traveling consistently, living in Airbnb since 2017. I've lived in there for 2,500 nights, which is a life hack. People call me financially unsavvy by doing this, but because it is more expensive, but I don't have to worry about any bills, cable bill, electricity bill, internet bill, taxes, and all that stuff. When I move out, I just move out. If you rent a 12-month lease, typically you have to repaint, you have to do this, you have to do repairs. It's like, it's crazy. So the amount of time it saves me is well worth the extra money. I move once a month. My zones are Southeast Asia, Eastern Europe, and all of Latin America, including the islands. And I foresee myself doing that in the future. I'm a minimalist as well, I identify as, which means I have the things that I actually use. I don't have 10 pairs of shoes. I have, well, one pair of casual shoes, one pair of gym shoes, and sandals. That's it. I travel with a small backpack and a carry-on luggage.
How do you pick your next city?
I'm thinking about your analytic comment. I could share my screen with you guys and show you my chart. I have a chart of cities and it breaks down by weather. I travel mostly by weather. So I have all the months that is not only dry, but warm. I look at various different things. I have a video on this as well as my personal channel. I have like 18 categories that I look at a city and then I measure that over cost. So like Dubai, for example, might have a bunch of things, you know, clean, good air quality, good gyms, good restaurants, nightlife, beach, but it's extraordinarily expensive. So is that value there when another city might have all those things and cheaper? So everything is measured over value. But I also travel based on events. I travel based on interest. Here in Tulum, I'm here because I'm looking at investments. I think it has if it has the potential that I think it might have, then I'm early. I would be very early on, but mostly weather, to be honest, mostly weather and no layovers. I really don't like doing giant layovers. One layover maximum.
I love how you have a spreadsheet for everything. It's kind of funny. this is great.
I do.
Just a curious, like, does it ever, like, you've been traveling now by yourself for 6-7 years now, like, does it get lonely ever, or are you like totally cool just being by yourself?
It does get lonely, but I will say that I feel like my loneliness factor is very low. It takes more for me to get lonely. In other words, I can be at home reading my book and whatnot by myself. But I do, that is one of the downsides. I do get lonely, but you can view that as an upside where it pushes me out of my comfort zone. Like even here, this is new for me. I really have to go out of my comfort zone, not only to go to events, but also to talk to people in events, to talk to people at co-working spaces like I'm at now, which makes me feel like I'm living, which is one of my ultimate core things. It's like when I'm on my deathbed, I think those who have lived the most lives within their life regret the least. So I'm trying to live the most lives as possible. And part of that is doing what I'm doing and putting myself outside my comfort zone.
I love that. Do you think you'll ever settle down, or are you going to be hopping around month to month for as long as you can see?
I don't know. I this really works for my lifestyle, for who I am. I really enjoy it. I could see I've been spending more time in Medellin, about 6 months a year, but even there, I'm like, I kind of get in this routine that I don't really love. Even in Medellin, I've lived in like 10 different neighborhoods. So even in the same city, if I'm there, I'm going to move around the neighborhoods. But I see myself traveling for a while. I have, you know, my top 5-7 cities that I like to go to, and I'm sure I'll gain more over the years. But I don't see myself living in a place permanently, as you know, traditionally people do, anytime soon. Maybe if ever.
Crazy. That's awesome, man. I love that. Dude, I love that kind of nomadic lifestyle. And I know a lot of people, Medellin's probably like one of the top places of like expats and kind of finding people that are in the same boat.
Tulum as well.
Yeah, Tulum. Yeah. Any other things that you want to share before we head into the final four?
Yeah, no, I've enjoyed my time here. Financial independence. I'm usually talking about like specifically Airbnb only stuff. So financial independence is very cool. Anyone who's listening to this, feel free to reach out to me. I kind of keep my professional life online and my personal life. So either one that interests you, go ahead and have a look and reach out to me there. And I look forward to meeting you. And if you see me somewhere, this happened to me yesterday, please say hi, but tell me that you don't know me, that you saw me online or something. I was walking to someone and they pointed at me, and I was like, you know, I'm like 20, 30 feet away. And I'm like, are they looking at me? And then eventually like, yeah, you. And I'm like, me? Well, why me? And they're like, oh, you don't recognize us, but we recognize you, et cetera. So yeah, that's always kind of a unique interaction, but it can be very awkward at the beginning if I'm like, did I do something wrong to you? I'm in Mexico now. I'm in Colombia. Who are you?
Yeah, that's so funny, man. All right, man, that all sounds good. But before we let you go, we have to do our final four, which we do with everybody. So, Chad, you know what time it is, right?
I do.
It's time for the final four. Boom. All right, kick us off, bro.
Yeah. Daniel, what book are you currently reading?
I have here. I'm currently reading. I read a lot. I read a bunch of books, but the book that I currently have is called Pablo Escobar, Mi Padre. I'm reading it in Spanish. It's written by Pablo Escobar's son.
That's cool.
Crazy. Wow. That sounds fun.
Yeah.
What is the best piece of advice you've ever received?
The best piece of advice I've ever received? Oh, what is that? I think maybe this is very, three words. My dad, I don't know if it's the best piece of advice, but it comes to mind, and it's very true, is I think he says, perception is reality.
Perception is reality.
Just means like, it doesn't matter what actual reality is. I mean, like, the best idea doesn't always win. Perception is reality. Yeah. There could be a crappy book out there, but if it has 10,000 reviews, that's the perception is that it's the best book. The reality is that it's a, you know, poorly written book. So perception is reality. I think about that.
Yeah, I think Robert Kiyosaki, I think it might even be in Rich Dad Poor Dad, where he
says... He may have got it from someone else.
it's just the same concept of just like, you've never heard of the best written book of all time, right? You've only heard of the best-selling book of all time. And so those two may be two very different things. And so just kind of that idea, and I couldn't agree more.
Rich Dad Poor Dad is on, I have a digital bookshelf on dannyboobo.com/ I think bookshelf, and I have my top 8 books of all time, of the hundreds, maybe 1,000 books that I read, and Rich Dad Poor Dad is one of those 8.
That's always a popular one on our show.
Yeah.
The next question is, what is your why?
My why, I think I alluded to, I think about this in general all the time, like when I'm on my deathbed, I want to feel totally satisfied. And how do I do that is living the most lives, pushing myself out of my comfort zone, learning how, not living a life, a very basic life, 9 to 5, not learning any new skills, not pushing myself out of my comfort zone. You know, I learned salsa dancing. I learned Spanish. I'm traveling. I want to learn how to play the drums. I want to learn how to be a pilot. I want to live a lot of lives. Even I've been in the military. Like, that's a different life. That's a life that I've lived. So my why is pushing myself, I guess, outside my comfort zone, living different lives as many as I can while I'm here on Earth.
Love that, man. Just for the record, I just went to your site and I'm looking at all the books that you recommend. And Influence, I'm reading right now, and it's really, really good. It's one of my favorites. So it would be in my list too.
Yeah, you can read a follow-up that he did on that, which is called Persuasion, which is how the things done before, you know, the meeting and whatnot actually lead to persuasion.
That's amazing, man. Yeah, we're funny enough, like with our team, the FI team, like, I'm going through the steps of influence with them to help them, you know, convert their clients and have influence. So, dude, love it. I'm gonna dive deep into your book recommendations later. But last question, or second to last question. What would be the worst buy one, get one free sale of all time?
I don't know. Maybe having a kid. this is coming from someone who doesn't have kids. Yeah. And who does have niece twins. I do have niece twins. Where I'm currently at, that would be my worst buy one, get one free situation.
Yeah, that's funny. Okay. Sounds good.
Elon Musk would not be proud with his worry.
No, Elon Musk has what, like 7 or 8 kids.
Yeah.
Yeah. What is the best place for people to find you?
You can type in Danny Boo Boo online. You can type in Daniel Rustin, or you can type in Optimize My Airbnb. My material is quite extensive, from YouTube to a personal website to TikTok to Twitter. That's how everything will pop up there.
Perfect. Daniel, thanks so much for coming on, man. It was great hearing your story. Super inspiring to see you and to hear about you traveling the world, as well as kind of running some successful businesses and playing the geo arbitrage game as well. And yeah, man, you're hitting it on all cylinders. So great chatting with you. Have fun in Tulum, and we'll talk soon.
Thanks, Daniel. Awesome stuff.
Appreciate you having me on.
Yep. See you, man.
Bye now.
And that was Daniel Rustine. Chad, what'd you think about Daniel?
Yeah, his life is amazing. He lives the nomad life of, I know that's a lot of some people's dreams, right? Of you doing it for a little bit. And the fact that he still loves it, you know, I think the pipe dream of, that sounds cool, but he has no intentions of ever settling down. He must truly obviously loves it. So that's a cool aspect of it. And just super, super knowledgeable about Airbnb. That's a little passion of mine. So I thought it was a great show. What'd you think?
I thought it was great. I love how he kind of broke down the three steps you said, right? Like optimize your listing, optimize your hospitality, then optimize your pricing. It's kind of like the three-step method. That makes a lot of sense to me. I never really thought about that. And then the stuff he was talking to about, don't give people double information. Like you don't need to describe exactly in words what they're seeing in the pictures, just like they can see that. And so that's stuff that a lot of people, I think, don't do. And I think Daniel has got a treasure chest of information, likely in his book, in the content he makes. So if you are trying to optimize an Airbnb you have, I highly, highly recommend going to check him out. And that lifestyle, man. Yeah, I think that's a lifestyle that a lot of people want to live. I can say that I did like a month in Southeast Asia at one point. I got to the point where I was like pretty lonely and I was like, I don't think I want to do this. Like that was actually my, I don't think I want to travel full-time moment. In 2019, I think that was. And so I just hated having that same conversation with people over and over again. Like, where are you from? What do you do? Like, it's all surface level stuff. I'm like, I need some like deeper connections here. So, but hey, he loves it. I'm not going to doubt it. I see the appeal because it is fun to travel. But yeah, anything else you want to say, Chad, before we hop off for the week?
Yeah, I guess just go back to like his Airbnb knowledge and what he was saying. I always say like everything in life, or the top 20% does 80% of the business or the whatever it might be, a restaurant. And I think that applies 100% to Airbnb. And so if you want to set yourself apart and succeed, there's so much competition. You got to do everything what Daniel was talking about. You have to optimize. You have to get rid of the unnecessary words. You have to have a great title. You have to have professional photos. And so, I think it's a great, if you want to be successful, I would recommend getting his book. And this episode is awesome.
Totally agree. I totally agree. Yeah. I mean, I still think back to my first Airbnb listing in 2017, where I just like had an unmade bed with like clearly super cheap stuff. And I was pulling in like $1,100 a night for a room in my house.
Things have changed.
That wouldn't fly today. Yeah. Awesome, Chad. Well, hey, thanks so much for listening, guys. Again, before we sign off, we obligatory need to ask you for a rating and review on the show, Investify, iTunes, Spotify, wherever you're listening. And also make sure you give Chad a follow at, what's your Instagram, Chad?
Yeah, Rocky the Realtor, R-O-C-K-E, the Realtor.
Rocky the Realtor. Make sure you give me a follow. I'm at the Fi Guy, and we will come to you again next week. See ya.
See ya.
That's it for this episode of Investify. We hope that these nuggets of real estate wisdom lead to more savvy financial planning and a clearer path towards financial freedom. For more content like this, subscribe to the show at investify.com. Don't forget to leave a rating and share it with your friends. Together, we can transform more real estate newbies into successful and clever investors. Thank you so much for listening. See you on the next one.